Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise About Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the host of the Rise About Justice Movement podcast and the founder of the Rise About Justice Movement. If you do not know, we are a national grassroots movement of sexual and gender-based violence survivors and allies coming together to fight for policies that will help enhance our lives and hold those accountable for who do these heinous crimes within our communities. Today, I would love to give a viewer discretion as advice due to the nature and the context and the topics that we will be discussing. Today, I am joined by somebody who is absolutely incredible. Literally just met her online by watching her video with unfiltered stories, which you can find on YouTube. Bethany, welcome to the Rise About Justice Movement podcast.
Hey, thank you so much.
So let's dive right in. So you wrote a book that is called Consistently Inconsistent: Rising from a Monster's Control. You are a published author, you are an advocate, you are a catalyst for change, and you're an overall all-around badass human being. And let's just dive right in. Walk
All
us
right.
through who Bethany is, what's your journey, what's your story, what inspires you. Just dive right in.
God, we'll be here all day.
That's okay.
thank you. That's quite the introduction. So my name is Bethany, and I have been through it. I think all of us have been through it, but my story seems to be the culmination of so many different things that I don't know. It makes for a story, so that's why I wrote the book. I was born and raised a pastor's daughter for the evangelical church. And so being a daughter in that situation, being a female in that situation, you grow up with specific expectations of what your future will hold, such as motherhood, marriage first, motherhood, and living a godly life, fully submitting to your husband. And I grew up and did just that and wound up through quite the ordeal. We can just cut it super short and then dive into details later. But I was married for 14, almost 14 years, to a federal law enforcement officer who was incredibly abusive, who was an alcoholic, and who is currently facing. He is in a 20-year prison sentence for five felonies he committed against me. And so, because of that, and after that, I have worked through and done as best I could to heal and learn. Went back to school. I'm getting my degree in psychology, and I advocate for all victims of domestic violence. I'm a big advocate for human beings in general, no matter what kind of group they're in, marginalized or otherwise. I care about the heart of a soul, and I really push for people to understand that they are loved and that they are needed and that they are seen. That is my big motto.
And I feel like anybody who does this work should have, that style of thinking, because these are stories that you don't just, you can't just tell, right? Because there's a lot of emotion behind it. There's a lot of feelings behind it. And, you're very open whenever it comes to sharing your story. And really quickly, I want to talk about some statistics on domestic violence within the United States. There is a lot going on. I mean, whenever we look at the headlines, we see mass shooting after mass shooting after mass shooting after mass shooting. Today is September 28th, and alone today, there has been four mass shootings in four separate states. In the city of Kansas City, Missouri, there is an increase in domestic violence-related homicides. One of them was a very prominent teacher within the Kansas City area. Her name was Brazen King, and she was a very prominent teacher within Kansas City. She was pregnant at the time, and she was a mother of five. And why do I share this? Why do I do the work that I do? Because these stories do not reach those limits. Brazen Cain was 42 years old and became the 18th victim of intimate partner violence in Kansas City. She was devoted to her boys, was pregnant with a sixth, and was a light to other mothers in her family. Unfortunately, she was killed in her front yard on August 6th, struck first by a pickup and then shot 21 times. Her former boyfriend was charged with first-degree murder and armed criminal action. In her death, she was pregnant with that person's son, and that was also the father of her youngest, which is 2 years old. With that said, the city is seeing a major trend and an alarming risk of domestic violence-related homicides within the city of Kansas City, Missouri alone. This does not paint a picture for across the entire country, as it's a major uptick in domestic violence. And going into October, October honors domestic violence survivors and victims by being the National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. So I want to make sure that we recognize that the violence against women is on the rise. The violence against marginalized communities is even higher than in previous years. And I want to highlight about from the National Domestic Violence Hotline, an average of 24 people per minute are victims of rape, physical violence, or stalking by an intimate partner in the United States. More than 12 million women and men over the course of a single year, nearly 3 in 10 women, or 29%, and 1 in 10 men, 10% in the United States, have experienced rape, physical violence, and/or stalking by a partner, and reported it having a related impact on their functioning. So, Bethany, hearing these statistics, hearing the story of Brazen Cain, hearing the stories of so many other survivors, how can we continue as a community and as a society recognize the ongoing epidemic of domestic violence, gun violence, sexual assault, intimate partner violence, trafficking, because it's all intertwined and it's all connected, right?
Of course.
And we see that. We see this ongoing uptick of violence running rampant through our communities, and it leaves a lot of the questions that we're all asking unanswered. So, how do we as a society continue to uplift these experiences and these stories? And then we're going to dive into your survival story.
No, I think, reporting obviously needs to stop being something we feel shame for. And I say we as a human race. I do not at all, because I hear those statistics and I know that they are against women, because women are we f there is some we feel some sort of freedom to report a little bit more than men do. But I also understand that men typically don't report. So we hear that 1 in 10, that 10% of men, or whatever it was, about men reporting. I bet you it's more than that. And so
Oh,
I
absolutely.
really think that we need to let go of the stigma of
Yes.
not believing the victims.
Yes.
Sure, are there people out there who manipulate a situation? Absolutely. But I promise you that that statistic of those kinds of people is so ridiculously small. Believe everybody until there's a reason not to believe them. That's what I
Absolutely.
just, it's for me in my situation, I didn't tell anybody, because the thing that continued with it went through my mind is, why would anyone believe me? It makes no sense. That's where it was wrong. I should have had people maybe not recognizing it, because I was a great actress, trust me. But we have to believe people. Even I've seen some funny reels that, I think it's all satire, but where the women will be walking arm in arm with a man, and then they'll bump into somebody, and then they'll put their hand behind their back and do that international sin the symbol, with the hand opening and closing. And where the satire comes in is where the people will be like, oh no, there's nothing wrong. And then we have the big guy that comes in and rescues the girl, or big girl that comes in, whatever. We need that to actually become a thing where if we see that, it doesn't matter what's going on. It's not a second guessing. We jump in. I don't care if it's a man. I don't care if it's a woman. I don't care what it is. If we see somebody in trouble, you have to step in. I was at the grocery store about a year ago, and there was a woman walking around with her partner, and she had two black eyes. Her arm was in a sling. And the first thing, I mean, I didn't even think. I just walked right up to her and I looked her dead in the eye. I said, "Are you okay?" I didn't care. I didn't worry. Even if it embarrassed her, that didn't need to even be a thought. Are you okay? She's like, "Yeah, I was in a, thank you. I was in a car accident yesterday." And I said, "Are you telling me the truth? Because I will get you out right now." It has to be that instinct. It has to be. We cannot second guess anybody. That's how we start. And then after that, we advocate and we continue to advocate. We cannot let spousal abuse, partner abuse, we can't, any intimate abuse, we can't do it. We don't want it for our kids. Why would we want it for anybody? Elderly, even elderly care, right? We can control believing the people who are speaking out. And I think that's what's most important to do.
Absolutely. Oftentimes we hear about like different survivor stories, and then we watch TV shows like the Special Victims Unit on TV, for example, and they make it look like you can just walk into the station and automatically be believed. But we know damn good and well that literally is not the truth,
Right.
right? And we oftentimes hear about reporting. I attempted to report, but I wasn't believed.
Right.
And that, unfortunately, that's a common theme amongst survivors and something that I hear literally on a daily basis. And I didn't report because I didn't report because, and oftentimes, 9 times out of 10, that's because they were not believed to begin with by their local police department, especially in rural communities.
Yes.
And it's just so incredibly bizarre that it's 2025. And we see this major uptick. And thinking about like the Violence Against Women Act that was signed as a federal law in 1994 that provided comprehensive responses and resources to combat domestic violence, sexual assault, dating violence, and stalking. It's been reauthorized several times, including in 2022, but there's a very huge risk that this is going to be completely cut. What are your
Yeah.
thoughts on that?
I'm terrified. I'm terrified. I think about the women who have confided in me and, are still with their abusive partners or have recently left their abusive partners. And those are just the people I know, and they're terrified. I had one call me at midnight and I don't know what to do. What if this happens? And it just happened to be, what was it, a couple weeks ago when the man who is in charge of our country right now just said, "Oh, what about, they're trying to say it's a crime, a little fight between a husband and wife." That sent me spiraling, to be honest with you. That really hit me. It sent several of the ladies that I speak to, sent them spiraling because what do you mean? We're gonna just let that go? So I'm terrified for anybody if that becomes the norm. I just don't know what that would mean. And it's gross. It's very gross.
Domestic violence has been recognized by the federal government as a national public health crisis and as a safety crisis. And a national survey by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that 4 in 10 women and 1 in 4 men have experienced physical or sexual violence when talking by an intimate partners. Going back to what I mentioned about earlier with those statistics, the 19th News did an article about Donald Trump's comments downplaying domestic violence in speech about religious freedom. And in that speech, you kind of mentioned it a little bit ago. In that speech, he stated, they said crime's down 87%. I said, no, it's more than 87%, virtually nothing, and much lesser things. Things that take place in the home, they call crime. They'll do anything they can. they can to find something. If a man has a little fight with a wife, they say this was a crime. See? So now I can't claim 100%, but we are a safe city. Those are his direct words in regards to, and he said this during like Religious Freedom Commission's meeting at the Museum of the Bible in
Right.
Washington, D.C., which is literally insane to me anyway.
Yep.
We have a museum of the Bible?
Yeah. That was news
What
to me
the
too.
hell?
That
Since
was news to me too. And then to have, I'm still
when?
confused by what the whole separation of church and state means. Apparently I'm the only one that just doesn't see that ever happening. But for him to be there and then say these things where how many people who have a Bible in their hands, who preach from the Bible, who, oh, that's what he said. Oh, okay. So I don't have to worry about that anymore. You're joking. I struggled. When I say I spiraled, I spiraled. This became everything that seems to come out of his mouth, people take very seriously. And so now we don't, now it's just not a thing. Come on now.
Oh God, yeah, absolutely. And oftentimes whenever there's a mass shooting that happens, we oftentimes hear about thoughts and prayers, right? But here's the thing. Annunciation Catholic Church and school in Minneapolis was literally attending a mass. Literally attending a mass, literally praying. If
Literally.
thoughts and prayers worked, because we know damn good well it doesn't. You want to know what does work, Bethany? It's called a thing that is very simple, very easy to do. It's called policy and action. And electing the people that will push the policies that we firmly believe in to enhance our lives, help our lives, support survivors, and advocate for survivors. It's you would think that this would be literally common sense, but it's clear that common sense does not exist in this country anymore. It
Oh,
is very clear.
common sense doesn't line their pockets.
Exactly. And that's the thing. And then you have these dangerous rhetoric or rhetoric, however you say that word, rhetoric, rhetoric, something like
Rhetoric.
that.
You're good. You're good.
But we have this very dangerous rhetoric in the country that, oh, this is, trans people, or this is a drag queen, or this is this, or this is that. When in reality, it's not.
Yeah.
And I want to dive in and talk a little bit about like your story is very complex, so walk us through meeting your husband. Walk us through just walk us through your story, like where it began, what happened, and now where you are now. And this is the point of the podcast where people are used to people rambling. So feel free,
Oh no.
part of this podcast. And I don't do a lot of editing on the podcast, and there's a reason for that. And I'm not going to edit this part out either because I believe people need to hear the actual voices behind these numbers and behind these statistics, because behind each statistic, there is a human being. And that is the reality of it. So, whenever we talk about the 1 in 10 or the 4 in 10, those are actual human beings that create those statistics. And let's do a deep dive into your story and where you are now, like what got you to this point, because it hasn't always been this easy.
No. I think I'm going to preface with I didn't understand my story. I did not understand what was going on in my world until I was out. So, for anybody, and I do say this in my book, for anybody who starts to get that icky feeling or starts to question, pay attention to those feelings and pay attention to those questions, because if you're doubting it, there's something that you need to look deeper into. So for me, as I said, I was born and raised as an evangelical pastor's daughter. We had a very stereotypical family where mom stayed at home, raised the kids as long as she could. We did lose our house in an earthquake when I was young, so that put us into a financial situation where my father ended up leaving the church. But we still had those ideals, and after we moved to a much smaller area, that my family dynamic changed just ever so slightly, except for kind of how we were run. Father was head of the house. Father was, it was spirit, he's the spiritual leader, financial leader for the most part. My father was not controlling in that way at all. My mother was a good support system, for him, for us. It seemed okay for a while. Eventually, my mother became addicted to pain medication, which became its own thing. And I really became the mother of my sibling at around age 12. Just always taking care of them, kind of just fulfilling my role. And a lot of things were quite strict for me. I couldn't, it wasn't okay for me to have a boyfriend. I couldn't wear certain clothes. Heaven forbid my modesty is shown, that kind of stuff. So, of course, I married the first guy that was nice to me after I turned 18. I met him at a college event. I was at the local city college, and I went to our bigger university for a kind of a combined event. Met him there, and he was 22. Again, I was 18, and he was 22. He was almost done with his degree. He had a full-time job. He had prospects. He had it just, and he was a Christian. And I think I said in my book that he was Christian enough, for my mother to love him, and rebel enough to piss my dad off. And I loved that. So we got married when I turned 19. We'd only been together a year. And in that year, I noticed some things that didn't feel right. We fought a lot. But according to him, his parents fought all the time, and they'd been married nearly 30 years. So if you don't fight, he would say, if you don't fight in a relationship, you're not going to last. Well, that to me, of course, so fighting every single day to the point of screaming, and him kicking me out of the car on the side of the road a lot while driving, even on highways, things like that, I was still learning and trying to fulfill my role as a Christian woman, as a future Christian wife. So in that year, I just kind of formed. And looking back now, I can say I was groomed. Of course, I'd been groomed from the time I could walk, but I was groomed to his standards. And we were, like I said, very young. Got married, tried to figure life out. He finished his degree. I was pregnant quickly. By the time we'd been married 2 years, our first child was born. I was very isolated. We lived in rural communities of no more than 1,000 people in the towns, things like that, very small. But it was okay, and I didn't know any different. I had my child, and all was good. And then quickly after that, my husband got a full-time job as a federal law enforcement officer. And I watched that man, who was already pretty egotistical, already pretty, now I can see it, narcissistic. I didn't understand it then. He got a badge. And I cannot explain to you the transformation that happened as soon as that ceremony was over and he could yield that beautiful piece of brass and a gun and a duty belt and have his law enforcement vehicle parked in our driveway. And it was disgusting. But I went along with it and was proud to be an LEOW, law enforcement officer's wife. We had our second child very quickly after our first child was born. And we moved through the motions, bought a house. But every day got worse, it felt. Every day, I would say to myself, it shouldn't be this hard. Nothing made sense to me why it just was so difficult to make a move every day, just to walk from one end of the house to the other. I was not allowed to wear makeup often. I was not allowed to go out without his permission. My debit card was not my debit card. It was his debit card. I didn't have access to those things. I never finished college. I didn't have any employment. I was my children's mother. I made dinner. I made sure he was satisfied. And that was it. That was my life. And around the time our second child was about 2 to 3 years old, something was going on in our marriage. And this is the part where I get a lot of eye rolls, believe me, because it's silly. But you must remember, I was 25, 26. I didn't understand how life worked. I was not allowed to have, I was not allowed to be on the internet all by myself. I had a lot of rules, and I found out about this book, and it was a trilogy even, and he was gone on an assignment. And because I felt that our marriage was slipping, and to him, sex was the only thing to keep us together, and we were barely doing that anymore, I read this stupid book. And I laugh at it now because it was so poorly written, and it became such an incredible whirlwind of popularity. It became two, maybe three movies. I don't even know. Just, it was, I'm not even going to say the name of it because we probably know what it is. But listen, there was something attractive about it because in that book, the man was very much in control and she was very submissive to him, and it introduced me to a lifestyle I did not understand. And so, in a place of desperation, I came to my then husband and said, "Hey, I read these books. I'm wondering, is this something you'd be into?" And when I tell you, his face lit up. Almost the same way it had on our wedding day, the love all of a sudden it seemed he had for me, the acceptance of me, the desire of me was there again. And I thought, oh my God, I've done something right. He's not going to hate me. Because listen, from that point, we had not even been married 5 years yet, okay? But at that point, I was not physically abused, mentally, yes. Emotionally, yes, but I didn't recognize any of that. I just knew it shouldn't have been that hard. There shouldn't have been so much fighting. There shouldn't have been me not being able to be myself. I'm this, I when I met him, I was this little gothic emo girl that loved all black. And now I'm in country clothes and wearing cowgirl boots and being forced to watch rodeo stuff, like things I just didn't care about, but I became that. I stopped writing. I stopped writing my poetry. I stopped writing in journals. I just became everything he wanted me to be. But because I had lost a lot of the light in his eyes, I thought, okay, well, sex is it. This is how I get him back. And so I read these stupid books and I gave them to him and I said, "What would you like me to do?" And he said, "You will now call me sir." At that point, I was not allowed to touch him. He took on this BDSM role in a disgusting way. I could not touch him without permission. If I did, I was punished. I could not hug him. I could not hug my own husband without permission, or I was punished. I could not look him in the eye, or I was punished. And heaven fucking forbid I looked at or speak to another man, even a waiter who is asking me what I would like off my menu. If I did, I would be punished. And listen, when I tell you punished, that meant a sexual punishment that I don't think most people understand. Because see, rape between a husband and wife doesn't exist. Right? My body, according to the Bible, belonged to him the moment I said my vows and that ring went on my finger. So, whether I wanted to or not, whether I was menstruating or not, whether I was sore or tired or sick, it didn't matter. If I didn't give it up to him, it would be taken from me anyway. And now we throw in the BDSM. So, now we've got whips, we've got riding crops, we've got ways to hang me upside down for hours on end, which did happen. There'd be me being left tied to the bed. Now, I am in no way, please, as a disclaimer, am I shaming anyone who is into that? Because that is not it. What he was doing was wrong. There was no consent, and it was disgusting, and I would be sick. I'm a type 1 diabetic. He'd leave me hanging upside down without my insulin pump and would walk away. These things were disgusting, and it was a nightly thing. And then alcohol became his number one baby as well, because life at his job was difficult. So we'd have the BDSM situation. We'd have the alcohol situation. We'd have the verbal abuse that became rampant. The amount of times I was called an incompetent bitch. I mean, I almost had that tattooed on me because that was just my name. I was stupid. I wouldn't shut up. I was immature. How dare I cry because I have feelings? Things like that. So that was 2012 when all of that really became a thing. And over the next several years, it got worse and it got worse and it got worse. My mother passed away from what we believe was a overdose from her pain medication. And he didn't care. He came home from an assignment, very angry. I was punished for it because I didn't have the house clean when he came home, despite the fact I'd just lost my mother. Little things like that. So people would ask at this point, why didn't you leave? Well, my oldest child had epilepsy. We had had that going on as well. So on top of everything else, our oldest child had been diagnosed with epilepsy. A week after my mother's memorial service, we got the phone call that our oldest would be having brain surgery. We got the actual date. That phone call, for some reason, my ex-husband had gotten that call, not me. It was very odd. Usually, I, as the mother, I'd be the one getting the call, but he got the call. He hung up the phone. He grabbed the kids and he walked out the door. I had no idea what happened. When he came home, he had enough alcohol to host a party. And he had already popped his first beer as he's walking into the house with the children. And he proceeded to drink and to drink. And I'm making dinner and I'm trying to understand. I mean, he had told me about the date of the surgery. So I'm trying to understand and be understanding while dealing with my own emotions, but not showing it to him because I was not allowed to have feelings or emotions. I was not allowed to cry. And he drank and he drank, and it got to a place where the children were asking questions. Daddy, what are you, why are you acting funny? They were 6 and 4 at the time. And I grabbed one of the, I believe it was a can of beer. I grabbed it, tried to grab it out of his hand, and he pushed me and I fell and hit my head on the pantry door and lost consciousness. When I came to, he was carrying me over his shoulder, fireman carry style. Kids were screaming. He was screaming at them to get into their rooms. And he slammed me down on the bed and proceeded to choke me while I was trying to understand what was going on. I'm still not quite conscious. He said I was faking it and that if I wanted to pass out, he'd make sure I'd passed out. He ripped my clothes off. He was so drunk that nothing really could happen sexually, which I, believe me, had gotten used to at certain points and was thankful for. But he was still choking me, pressing me deeply into the mattress face down, so I was not able to breathe. I had grabbed my phone and I dialed 911, but had not hit send at that point. But somewhere along the way, whether it was an elbow or it was him, I'm still not sure. Law enforcement was called. It was obviously a deadline. All the dispatcher could hear was me screaming. And law enforcement showed up and he answered the door completely belligerent and naked. Law enforcement found me in the house. I'm trying to help our children. I had tried to escape through my kids' window earlier in that evening with the kids. But I was able to, he pulled me back in, so I locked them in their room. So when I went, when law enforcement found me and cleared me to be able to go get the kids were looking out the window and watched Daddy, wrapped in a towel, get handcuffs put on him and taken to the car. And all they'd ever known from law enforcement was the good guys, and that's what Daddy was. So what are they doing, Mommy? He went to jail, and that night he called me so many times from the jail cell. Of course, I was every name under the book. His mother called me and called me every name under the book. How could I? How dare you? What is wrong with you? You ruined my son's life. His grandmother called me and said, "What is wrong with you? Don't you know? I mean, I've had grandpa put a gun to my head and I never said anything." And I realized he was the way he was because they were the way they were. And this was a very disgusting situation. And what the fuck was I doing being married to this? However, my child needed brain surgery. And this is where the why did you stay comes in hardcore. And it makes me sick, but I would never take it back. My child needed brain surgery. And I bailed him out of jail and begged for his job to keep him so that we could have the insurance, the federal law enforcement, the federal insurance to cover our child's brain surgery that wound up not being one, not two, but ended up being four different brain surgeries and a 2 week stay in the hospital. Really long, like most of it ended up being about 2 months in the hospital back and forth. But I stayed, and I did the typical victim thing, the stereotypical victim thing, and I told them that I was wrong, that it wasn't that bad. The DA begged me not to say that. The DA begged me just to be forthright and honest, and I couldn't. And I hope still somewhere in there, I hope that they would understand that I wasn't crazy. I wasn't even in love with this guy. I needed it for my kid. It's hard, but you don't know until you know. So, the child got the brain surgeries they needed. My ex-husband at the t you know was court ordered to go to counseling. We ended up moving and we tried to start life over. And after a year or so, maybe a couple years, something happened to him at work. And he had really, for the most part, stopped drinking, by the way. So the abuse was still going on, but it wasn't as violent. And he never laid his hands on me in that way. It was very sexual all the time. Sexual abuse was just be that was just a norm. I didn't understand anything else. I didn't know kindness in the bedroom. But as the time had gone on, and as we had gone to the new location and moved houses and really tried to start over, he got in trouble at work for a false arrest. I still do not know the details, but I do know that he was not allowed to return to work until the full investigation had gone through, which took months and months and months, which forced me to get a job, which really aggravated the situation because now his wife was making money and he was not. So the drinking became ridiculous. It was bad. It was very bad. And I feel like I skipped so many details in here, but we really would be here all day. But eventually he got relocated again out of punishment for his job. It was that or get fired. And so we up and moved our whole life again. And on January 1st in 2018, I woke up, and this is where everything changed for me. I woke up and I said, no more. I can't. I don't know how. I don't know when, but I will no longer be in this situation. I cannot do it. And when I tell people that, like, it was such an aha moment. Some people would say it was God. Some people would say the divine universe. Some people, whatever it was, that's what happened. And I woke up and I said, no more. How? I have no education. I've got no money. I've got nothing to my name. I don't know, but we're going to get out of here. And so over the course of the next several months, I paid attention to everything that he was doing. He had stopped drinking, had gone keto, started doing jujitsu, which just made his narcissism. Whew, I thought it was bad before, but now he was a jujitsu master and had the moves. And that was, yeah. And so it didn't matter because I paid attention. I recorded him. I wrote down things and kept it in my secret places. I just had to have enough evidence in order to justify me leaving. And he was gone on an assignment. And over the summer, my youngest and I were having a conversation. I said, "Hey, Daddy's coming home." My youngest, who was 8 now, looked me dead in the eye and said, "Please, Mommy, no. Things are so much better when Daddy's not here." As a parent, as a human, really, but as a parent, when you hear a child say that, you realize that you're the reason that you are staying no longer needs it needs to be your reason. That was it for me. And I was speaking to my ex-husband on the phone, and I went ahead and told him that our youngest did not want him home, and that has me concerned. And I think maybe we need to take a look at making some different choices. Well, that resulted in me having to escape because he said he was coming home and he was going to kill me. He said he no longer loved me, which was kind of a relief because biblically, as he threatened, he would just go sleep around. Biblically, that was my only out. My mom warned me when I was a kid that if a man ever lays his hands on you, you run. No matter what Jesus said to do, you run. Now, granted, Jesus never said anything about abuse, but the Bible did say only that the excuse was to be, have your spouse cheat on you. That was it. That's the only way to get out of your marriage. Even if they died, in the Old Testament, even if your spouse died as a woman, you're still obligated to stay with them. And that's bizarre, but anyway. He said he didn't love me and that he was going to cheat on me. And so I actually prayed, please, oh, please do. Please let me find a reason that you cheated on, find that you did cheat. Please, please, please. And he screamed that he was coming home and he was going to kill me. And so I escaped to my father's house for that weekend. And I had to go back after the weekend was over. Children still needed to go to school. My ex told me that it was going to be okay, that he had calmed down, that we needed to talk. And so we came home and he was waiting there. And I'm talking, I had flowers waiting for me. I had presents waiting for me. I had boohoo tears from this man dropped to his knees. I am 5 feet tall, and this 6 foot man dropped to his knees, held me. I'm so sorry. I do love you. There was nothing in it for me anymore because I knew I was not safe. About 24 hours later would go by, and we had fought to a point where he had gone to a hotel. I got several threatening text messages that would scare anybody. And then the moment came where I got a notification. I don't know if it was an accident. I'm not sure if he did it to be manipulative. I'm not sure, but I got a notification that he had purchased the gold package from Tinder. And that was my out. I was done. I can't explain to you. I was terrified. I was so scared, but I was laughing hysterically. I remember calling my best friend and I had screenshot that and sent it to her. And I just was laughing to the point of tears. I think I was so scared and so relieved at the same time. Good. He got Tinder and he was at a hotel. Please, I hope, I can only hope that that happened because I'd be free. He came home that next morning at 7 in the morning, and said, I'm taking the children to school. And when I get back, you and I are going to have a talk. He left. I texted everybody in my circle that I had, the whole three people. My best friend, I texted my father and another girlfriend of mine and said, hey, he's here. He came back last night or this morning. Sorry. He came back this morning. And if you don't hear from me, it's not going to be good. And he came back and we talked for a little bit. And I said that I was done and I wanted a divorce. And he immediately grabbed me by the throat, took me into the bedroom, slammed me down the bed, just like he had the first time. And this time he was not drunk. And this time he'd been through jujitsu for a year. I knew I would not be able to win this fight. But for 4.5 hours, I struggled and I fought and I ran and I got chased out of the house. I got my head slammed against the wall and into a picture frame, actually, of us on our wedding day. I had my clothes ripped from the bottom of my shirt all the way to the collar. I was held hostage. I ran out of the house at one point. And again, we were in a rural area, so we don't have neighbors, so it didn't matter how loud I screamed, nobody heard me. But he dragged me by my hair in back into the house. You know, it almost could be a movie how that went down. A horror movie, obviously, but so many times. And I got to a place in all of this where my body was so tired and I just begged him, can I please go to the bathroom? And he had let me. He had already taken my keys, he'd already taken my phone, and I do not remember how I was able to sneak my phone. I don't know how I don't remember that part. But I ran into the bathroom and I was shaking and doing what I could to just text my father and my stepmother. And I said, he's here. He's hurting me. I'm probably not going to make it. Can you get the kids from school? I didn't know what else to say. Hit send, panicked. And deleted it before I actually got the notification that it had sent to them. In my brain, which was not working quite right at that point, it had been a little over 2 hours, maybe 3 hours of this ongoing just screaming and running, and I don't know. I just was terrified that that didn't go through and that no one would know. I had Snapchat. I was not allowed to have Snapchat, but because he had been gone on an assignment, I liked the filters. I loved to play with my kids with those stupid things. But I had a couple friends on Snapchat, and one of them was a gentleman I had just met. And we were just friends, just like I said, just a few friends. And this was when Snapchat had just released the feature that you could see where people were on a map unless you said no. I hadn't even gotten to that point of like not showing my location. But I sent out something on Snapchat to my friends and then this gentleman, and I said, my husband's here. He's hurting me. I'm not gonna make it. I didn't know what else to do. And I knew that those messages deleted as soon as those people would read them. So that's what I did. And at that point, of course, he's banging on the door. He's screaming profanities at me. And he's saying, I mean, just, it's time to die. I'm going to get you kind of stuff. And he came into the bathroom. I hid my phone in a drawer, I think, or maybe he grabbed, I literally don't remember, because that at that point is when he slammed me down on the ground, he tried to make me perform oral on him. He raped me. He did all kinds of things. And at one point, I was on the bed and his duty belt was right there. And I remember looking up at it and going, and seeing his gun and going, I could do this. I'd be justified. I would be justified. Now, keep in mind, his hand is around my throat. I am losing air. I'm losing, starting to feel dizzy. My body is so exhausted. And I really did. I had that thought, like, what would happen? What would my kids think? I'd ruin their lives, but he'd stop. But obviously, he saw my face. He's an investigator himself, so he saw my face and he went, "Oh, this is what you're interested in." And he pulled that out and put it against my head and changed his mind, thankfully. And tied me up with his duty cuffs to his bed instead, and or to the bed and to the headboard. And I was losing air. He just he I don't his thing was really just making me lose air, so that I couldn't scream, I couldn't breathe, I couldn't whatever. It was just really his thing. And then his cell phone went off. And then his work phone went off. And when he saw his work phone go off, he said, "Well, they're here, baby. Time to go. I will love you forever." And he went to the door. And I'm seeing Tweety birds at this point. I don't remember much. And went to the door and I heard them. I heard a familiar voice actually say, "What the fuck? What are you doing?" And then I heard a little scuffle and that was it. And at that point, I kind of came to more. I was able to like pull my hands out of these handcuffs. And I got to my feet and went running. And that is where my husband's best friend, who we'd had dinner with, I knew his wife and their children, came running to me, full uniform. He said, "He's gone. He's gone, Beth. He's gone." And that led to 5 felonies that he pled guilty. Well, he took a plea deal for. It was corporal injury of a spouse, false imprisonment by violence, sexual penetration by foreign object with force and violence, rape of spouse by force, fear, and threat, and attempted murder. And so it's been 7 years almost since then. How do you say, "Oh, my life is great now"? You don't, and you do, because what I love to tell my survivors, what I love to tell the people that are going through it, is that you do get there. It might take a long time, it might take a short time. You do get there. And the odd thing for my life now is that the man, the way that all of it came down, the way that the cops came to the door, was that the Snapchat thing I sent out. The man I had just met, the guy I had just met, we were just friends, had seen it and went and contacted everybody on my Facebook page, found me on Facebook, went and contacted everybody, my family, my friends, and he found my best friend at the time. He had already taken a screenshot of where I was. I was in a new house she had not been to. He sent that to her. She called law enforcement, and that's how I didn't die that day. And that man on Snapchat, I wound up marrying, and we will be married 5 years now, in a little bit. And I hope you can hear me smiling, especially those of you who have gone through it, who have been in situations like mine. My goal is for you to understand that your survival is the beginning. It's the absolute beginning of your life. And you'll deal with a lot. It's going to be a lot of back and forth. You're going to have a lot of really hard days. I have a lot of really hard days. But even if you have one good day out of 30, trust me, you will learn to treasure that one day, that singular day. So that is my whole story. I am sure I left a lot out, but But if anything, I just want people to understand that this is real, that people do go through this. I was very lucky, and that is not lost on me. But I am good, and my oldest is in college and running cross country and hasn't had a seizure in 11 plus years. My youngest is thriving, and think good things come out of really dark places.
And look at what you have accomplished. You wrote a book, you're published, you're on podcasts, you share your story to inspire others. I'm at a loss of words because your courage, your strength, and just your energy is so beyond inspiring. And I know that people listening to this are going to go through like a roller coaster of emotions because I did being on this end and just hearing it. But it's one of these stories that it's like, okay, we get to like this like peak and then it drops back down. And it's like, okay, everything's going smooth and then something else happens and something else happens and something else happens. And this is why complex PTSD needs to be recognized in the DSM-5 by the American Psychological Association and future DSMs because, like DSM-6 and so on and so forth. Because complex PTSD, it comes from multiple occurrences, right? And that is something that a lot of people don't talk about. And, part of the movement that I created, 200 something thousand followers later, I'm sitting down talking to stories and or talking, oh, wow, sitting down and talking to people and listening to their stories like yours. It gives me the energy to keep going because it means that I'm doing the correct thing by amplifying these stories. Really quickly, I was doing some research, and from the Feminist Majority Foundation, the National Center for Women and Policing, I found a police family violence fact sheet. So this is going to be no surprise to you, Bethany, and anybody else who has encountered police violence. But I do want to point out that the most common discipline imposed for a sustained allegation of domestic violence was counseling. Only 19% of the departments indicated that officers would be terminated after a second sustained allegation of domestic violence. This was after a 1994 nationwide survey of 123 police departments documented that almost half, or 45%, had no specific policy for dealing with officer-involved domestic violence. And the reality is that even officers who were found guilty of domestic violence are unlikely to be fired, arrested, or referred for prosecution, raising concern that those who are tasked with enforcing the law cannot effectively police themselves. In 1998 to 1999, 23 domestic violence complaints were filed against Boston police employees, but none resulted in criminal prosecution. The San Diego City attorney typically prosecutes 92% of the domestic violence cases that are referred, but only 42% of the cases involving a police officer as the perpetrator are prosecuted. And then the last one that I want to point out is between 1990 and 1997, the Los Angeles Police Department investigated 227 cases of alleged domestic violence by officers, of which 91 were sustained. Of those 91 allegations that were sustained by the department, only four resulted in a criminal conviction. That means that the LAPD itself determined in 91 cases that an officer had committed domestic violence, but only four were convicted of on a criminal charge. Moreover, of these four officers who were convicted on a criminal charge of domestic violence, one was suspended for only 15 days,
Good
and
girl.
another had his conviction expunged.
Gross. And where are their spouses? What happened to them? They're lost. We don't hear about that. We only hear about what didn't happen, and it's gross.
The underreporting of sexual assault, domestic violence, etc., comes directly from police departments. I mean,
That's gross.
there are certain departments that are not required to report to the FBI. And then you have a local police department like the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department that is not controlled locally. It is controlled by a board of police commissioners that are appointed by the city and as well as the governor, but the state legislature and the governor have ultimate say on the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. And then they passed a bill to bring St. Louis Police Department under their control as well. Keep in mind, this year alone, in 2025, it is only September. There is already a steady increase of the number of homicides, like the one that I mentioned earlier about Brazen Cain. She became number 18 or 19 of those homicides that are domestic violence related specifically. We see this uptick. We see this major problem of violence running rampant in our communities and leaving families with these unburdened questions of why? Why my loved one? What did they do? And how can somebody have so much hate in their heart? How can somebody sleep at night knowing that they took another life at the hands of somebody else?
Yeah.
And my mom is a domestic violence survivor. I learned about her story as I grew up. And the courage and the strength that my mom has each and every single day to keep pushing forward, I don't know how she does it. I don't. Because, but she does it because she is a survivor.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the things that one of my co-founders told me was, your mom's going to heal from cancer. You know, she was diagnosed with stage three cancer or stage three cervical cancer in April of this year. But my co-founder told me that your mom is going to heal from cancer, but she will never forget what you did to her.
Yeah.
And I think that's absolutely true because she hasn't let anything stop her, you know. And I see a lot of you, Bethany, and her because you have very similar stories. Obviously, not necessarily every detail, but, you know, domestic violence does have a certain common trait, and it's that toxic masculinity aspect and the power of control,
Yeah.
you know. And that's the reality of it. My biological father is in prison. 29 years later, I've never met him a day in my life, but he's been convicted and he's in prison for many, many, many years to come.
Yeah.
It wasn't for a domestic violence charge. It wasn't for anything like that. It was actually drug offenses that, which, you know, I told my mom, she's like, I'm not surprised. But part of the reason for creating this movement is to honor my mom, but also to honor survivors and uplift the survivor voices. And with that, Bethany, I just want to continue this conversation, but this will go on for literally hours on it.
Yeah, I'm seeing.
But I just have one final question to you. And the final question is, if you were to receive a message from a survivor, which I know you have, just like I do on a daily basis, but if you were to receive a message from a survivor that was looking for resources or looking for ways to cope with their trauma, because this is the first time that they've ever shared their story, what would you tell them and why?
I think it's human dependent, to be honest, to be able to answer that question for me, because I on occasion I do get messages, and because each survivor story is different, I recognize that they might need different services, right? Some might not need services at all. Some might just need an ear to go, "Hey, I'm feeling funky today. I'm good normally, but I just wanted to talk." That's cool. Then I offer that. I will listen to you all day. Or maybe they need something stronger, like I need to get out. Where do I go? For those people, I say immediately you find your local victim services, find a safety house, make phone calls. I hate making phone calls. Trust and believe, I'd rather email or text. But in these situations, it's easier to call because you could just hang up if you need to. If that's not possible, there are websites that you can go to that will give you those resources that you can have quick exits. My number one thing is just to make sure to meet the survivor where they are at. And I think for those in the more needy situations, why I would tell them, I want them to be safe and healthy and get out. I want them to reach the people that will listen to them. And even if it takes a few people, I want them to survive. I want to see that they are gonna be safe, that if they have children, to get their children safe, that they will be all right. That's number one. If they need less, if they're, if it's not as needy a situation, I want them to feel like, yeah, hey, you woke up today. Isn't that great? Hey, you have really nasty breath. Guess what? You get to go brush your teeth. Go do that. That's a big win. I want to be able to encourage these humans who have been through a lot to see them for who they are and what they've already gone through and who what that has made them and the success that they are. So again, it's hard to answer that question straight because every person needs something different. I'd suggest therapy for some. I'd offer to move completely out of state for others. Find safety in certain areas or not. It really will depend. For me, it was difficult to run and hide when my then husband was federal law enforcement and literally could find me anywhere I went, right? So telling me to go to a safe house, that was not going to work. But somebody else might be able to find something. I'm one of those people, though, that if you are listening, for instance, you're listening to this podcast today and you're freaked out and you don't know what to do, please just email me or find me on social media and DM me. I'm not going to ignore you. And if I can connect you to great services or to great books even or other resources, I will be doing that. I think it's important. It's a human element that a lot of us continue to forget that we actually have within us that we can help each other. So, yeah, that was a really long answer to your question. But that's all I got.
Absolutely. I think it answers the question and it paints a picture that each story is different and each healing journey is also different, and what would have worked for me may not have worked for the next person. What may have worked for you may not work for somebody else. But I think the individualized healing and the decolonization of self-care is so incredibly crucial, and recognizing the need for decolonizing our health, decolonizing our communities, and also decolonizing the self-care techniques that oftentimes typically don't work, right?
Yeah.
But the decolonization is so incredibly crucial. And I know I can hear my Native American grandmother saying, yeah, absolutely. I can hear her saying it. But, Bethany, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. You are a bright light and a shining light in such a deep, dark world. And I am grateful to be connected to you. You know, you have an open invite anytime you would love to come onto the podcast.
Oh,
And
yeah.
with that, is there anything else you would like to share? Anything else you'd like to say?
I literally just am going to repeat my motto, and I want everyone to close their eyes and really hear me when I say this, that you are loved, you are needed, and you are seen. And I don't want anyone to forget that.
Wow. Thank you so incredibly much. Thank
Yeah.
you for being the shining light that so many are going to hear this and feel like they are less alone.
Of course.
Bethany, thank you so much.
Thank you.